The following program is not a production of Audio Journal. External programs like this are selected with the interests of our audience in mind and with the goal to inform and entertain. The opinions expressed in this program do not reflect the views and opinions of Audio Journal, its board of directors, staff, or volunteer readers. Thank you for listening to Audio Journal.
Hello, and welcome to the Women's Hour. I'm Mary Ellen. Thank you for joining me. Beginning today with the Washington Post, the woman who keeps beating men at America's most punishing running events, by Jason Nark. Rachel Entrekin was already known as the Queen of Cocodona when she arrived in Arizona this month for one of America's most punishing ultramarathons. Then the 250-mile race started. Entrekin, a two-time women's champion in the event, found herself running again with the elite males. And she began wondering, why not you? So she pulled away, crushing the course record by 7 hours, beating every man and woman in the field, and providing another example of how multi-day races have erased gender lines. Now at 34, Entrekin's the king of Cocodona, too, or maybe something more than that. One of my pacers has determined that I must be from another planet, Entrekin said in an interview, still buzzing from her historic win. Entrekin began running in 2009 as a student at the University of Alabama, before starting a career in physical therapy. She eventually started competing in half marathons, then full ones, before hitting longer ultramarathons in the Southeast and descending into what she called insanity. When she moved to Washington State and looked up at the vistas, she found her calling. I love running up mountains, she told For the Long Run podcast in February. Today, Entrekin is fully sponsored and has won or placed in about 100 ultramarathons, regularly beating men. At Cocodona, that meant finishing in 56 hours, 9 minutes, and 48 seconds. Killian Korth, the men's winner, finished 78 minutes behind her. Passing Korth and other top runners at the mile 60 was a test of Entrekin's why not you philosophy. I thought about my resume, that I've won this race twice already, and that I won lots of other 200-mile races and other 100-mile races. I'm just as qualified to be at the front of this race as they are. So why can't it be me? She said. I think I can do this, so why not? The ultimate ultra. Cocodona, which debuted in 2021, begins in the Sonoran Desert and weaves through red rocks, pine forests, and mountain ranges. It has quickly become a measuring stick for some of the world's best ultra runners. This year's race featured a mind-boggling 38,791 feet of elevation gain, which translates into miles of painful ascents and descents. It's been described as the race that breaks you, and many starters can't finish it. A female competitor died on the course this year from a medical emergency. Some social media posts from runners discuss feet that feel like raw hamburger, along with discussions about swollen tongues and videos of bloody foreheads. Hallucinations from lack of sleep are common. Entrenken may or may not have seen bats. Medics rushed in to meet one competitor who crawled across the line to the same chorus of cheers 125 hours after starting. Jamil Corey, the creator of the race, noticed that Cocodona's slogan is "Adventure awaits," not hell. The goal wasn't to make the most brutal breakdown possible, he said. We wanted to create an adventure that takes you through historic towns and incredible landscapes. Corey said Entrenken's performance this month was a bit shocking, and seeing her story break into mainstream media has been a joy. She has been on ESPN, Bloomberg Television, and Good Morning America since the win. She's the perfect person for this, Corey said. She's been dominant for many, many years, but she's just so energetic and positive. It's great for the sport. Where women rule. Entrenken has some theories about why women have excelled at longer distances. Top end speed is not the be-all, end-all in the multi-day running endurance scene, Entrenken said. I think women have a lot more practice, maybe dealing with adversity and managing our emotional state and communicating. She mentioned Anne Traysen, arguably the most accomplished female ultra runner of all time, and Tara Dower, who finished the 2,197-mile Appalachian Trail in 40 days, 18 hours, and 6 minutes in 2024 as examples. Entrenken, who now lives in Colorado, isn't calling for races to end gender categories and said she's self-assured enough not to care how her win is classified. She just wishes, as Traysen did decades earlier, that the conversation would evolve. I hope this is a step in the direction of maybe making men less of the measuring stick, she said. Amy Clark, editor of Ultra Running magazine, said Entrenken is one of a handful of elite women doing unprecedented things in the sport. She said Courtney Dowalter won the prestigious Moab 240 endurance run outright in 2017. And finished 6th overall at Cocodona. Entrenken, Clark said, has an uncanny ability to push through the lows that haunt every runner in ultramarathons. She's so tough and she goes hard, but she just has such a positive attitude. She doesn't let those lows pull her back, Clark said. Entrenken, Corey noted, finished the race relatively unscathed. She slept just 19 minutes total over those 56 hours. While she consumed precision-crafted electrolyte drinks and gels to hydrate, as most competitors did, she also had a Coke or two and a ton of mashed potatoes. She calls potatoes the unsung hero of ultra running. You just get tired of chewing, she said. In the past, loading up on candy and drinks at 7:11 was a pre-race ritual for Entrenken. She only recently started wearing a watch, and her cross-training consists of occasional yoga, she said. During the race, even one as serious as Cocodona, Entrenken is mostly all smiles, cracking jokes, petting dogs, and chatting up fellow racers. She's seemingly nonchalant about any setbacks, which are few. I fell in a hole, she said at one aid station. Instead of getting deep sleep and lots of real hot meals after her finish, Entrenken hung around Flagstaff to cheer on other finishers. She's not taking a beach vacation or any time off, really. In August, she's racing in the highly competitive Ultra Trail du Mont Blanc in France. She's been itching to go for a run, but interviews keep getting in the way. I mean, running is my favorite thing in the world, she said. Obviously. From L, Dolores Huerta was always a hero. At 96, the legendary organizer is seeing her legacy and contributions moved to center stage. By Alice Driver. Dolores Clara Huerta sits in a recliner in her living room, wearing bright red lipstick, with a grandchild and two great-grandchildren running behind her as she speaks. Clocking in at just 5 feet tall, the labor organizer has been a force for decades, organizing national boycotts, getting arrested for nonviolent protest, negotiating historic union contracts, and coining the phrase, si se puede, yes we can, which former President Barack Obama famously borrowed for his 2008 campaign. Huerta, who turned 96 on April 10th, the day before our interview, is a mother of 13, a feminist, a civil rights activist, and a survivor. In 1962, she co-founded the National Farm Workers Association, which later became United Farm Workers, with Cesar Chavez, and their decades of committed work resulted in better working conditions and pay for millions across the U.S. Chavez, who died in 1993, the more famous of the two, saw his name given to streets, buildings, and schools during his lifetime. But earlier this year, when reporters at the New York Times called Huerta for comment on an investigation about allegations of Chavez's abuse of girls and women, she revealed a secret she had held for nearly 60 years, that he had raped her. The article has spurred a recentering of women in social movements who worked diligently alongside men like Chavez, but let them take the credit. But now, with this reckoning, deserving women like Huerta are getting their flowers. The achievements won for farm workers and others are still there and cannot be erased, Huerta says, when asked how it feels to get so much appreciation at this point in her life. The support and love that I have received in this difficult moment has given me the strength and inspiration to continue working and seeking answers to end violence against women, girls, and boys. Huerta, who was born in New Mexico and moved to California as a child, became aware of injustice at an early age. I could see the poverty. Some of my friends were not treated the way they should have been treated, always harassed by the police and discriminated against in school because they were black or brown or Filipino, Mexican, she says. So I always had this anger inside of me also because of the way we were treated. Huerta and her friends formed a teenage club where they played table tennis and other games, and the police shut them down. They shut down our center, and the reason they shut down our center was because they didn't like to see these Anglo girls hanging out with black and brown kids, you know, Huerta says. Her first taste of organizing came via the Girl Scouts, where she learned to help people in her community. I tell people it was like finding the pot of gold at the end of the rainbow, she says of the formative experience. She is no stranger to the difficulty of taking on the powerful in the quest for justice. As a leader in the farm workers' movement, in her fight to ensure better labor conditions and pay for laborers, she confronted the power of agribusiness, oil companies, banks, and even the then governor of California, Ronald Reagan. And yet we were able to overcome all of them, she says with pride. Now, as she looks at the current political moment, she hopes to spur a similar call to action. We know that what we're going through in the United States of America right now is something that we've never seen to this extent before. It's never been as challenging as it is right now, she says, and especially for young people, when they think about what their future is going to look like, when so many benefits that have been fought for so many years that were finally won and now are being taken away from us, it's do or die. In the lead-up to the midterms this fall, Huerta wants to work with young people to get out the vote, knocking on doors at age 96. I love the idea of registering people to vote, she says, because you're talking to strangers and you're trying to convince them to do something that is not only good for them, but good for the country. Huerta's mother, Alicia Chavez Fernandez, shaped her and her two brothers' sense of justice and understanding of dignity and labor. Her mother was a divorcee and a business owner, not traditional labels for a woman at that time. As Mama used to tell us, if you can help someone else you see who needs help, then you have an obligation to do that. Even if they do not ask for help, that is your obligation as a human being, to help others, Huerta says. And you've got to live your life in that way. She set that as an example for all of us kids, that she would always help people in whatever capacity she could. Huerta remembers her mother helping a Japanese friend who was taken to the internment camps during World War II. Huerta carried that memory with her, a reminder of the kind of person she wanted to be. When Huerta began organizing at 25, she says, "Everyone thought I was absolutely crazy because it was like running away to join the circus." At the time, she had 5 children and was getting divorced. "I received a lot of criticism for not being a traditional Latina woman. Why don't you stay home with your children? What are you doing? Why are you always working?" What her critics didn't understand, she says, was that she had created an expansive community within the farm workers movement, and they helped her raise her kids. "I am not a regular mother," she says, explaining that for her kids, it wasn't an easy life, but at the same time, I would say it was kind of an exciting life for them because they were involved in building a movement on picket lines and strikes and marches and protests and meeting all kinds of people. In the 1960s, Huerta spent several years organizing the Delano grape strike and boycott by going house to house in California's Central Valley. Her message to workers was, they didn't have to be afraid. They could actually change the system. They had the power to do so. The campaign is considered one of the most effective collective actions of its time, convincing about 16 million Americans to stop eating grapes. And that is how we were able to win our struggle to get basic human rights for farm workers. And we could do that again. When looking at organizing now, she says she thinks the effectiveness of the grape boycott inspires activists today. "What gives me a lot of hope is when I see all of the people coming out to stop these horrible detention centers," she says. For young people who may feel timid about getting involved in their communities, Huerta says, "People don't believe it sometimes when I tell them that I was shy when I was a kid. I was very shy, and my mother would always push me. You've got to speak out, you know, even if you feel a little embarrassed, and even if you say the wrong thing." As an organizer, she says, she learned to swallow her fear and do the work, and she hopes that younger generations will follow her lead. This is our moment. Probably the greatest moment in history that we have right now to save our democracy, to save our country, and to save the world, she says. Now, as she works with Gregory Nava, who directed Selena, on a scripted film about her life's work, she sees it as an opportunity to inspire. She describes the movie as being about how people can find their power, and once they find their power, what miraculous things can come out of that, she says. It's about how simple, everyday people can find their power. Just like her. From the Boston Globe magazine, Perspective. From full-time single parent to my own person, by Carrie Simonelli. A trinagle is the strongest shape, my younger daughter first told me when she was little. It was more life lesson than math lesson. Here was this kid, too young to be able to pronounce triangle, but smart enough to equate each of us, me, her, and her sister, with one of its sides, inseparably bound, and, well, stronger for it. The phrase became our mantra. Though she's 18 now, and her sister is 20, it's been the three of us, always, since I got divorced when they were small. But with high school graduation and college on the horizon for her, and my older daughter moving into her own apartment 3 hours away, a seismic shift is coming. It's not just my girls who are ready to navigate a new reality. At the risk of forever being cast as a bad mom, I can't wait for them to go. After all this time, I want my life back. Raising them has not been some selfless pursuit. If anything, it's been the opposite. I loved seeing them trying new things and watching their worlds expand. I chose to spend my time being a youth career cheer coach and a Girl Scout leader and a field trip chaperone. And they are choices I'd make again every time, except the trip where the bus broke down. The past 20 years have been a blur of dance lessons and karate classes, drives to practices, games and competitions, washing team uniforms at midnight, because why mention it's dirty before then? And frantic TJ Maxx trips, because of course you need a cowboy hat for tomorrow. And while I cherish all of it, being a mother is all-consuming. Maybe you have to cancel dinner with a friend so many times that she just stops asking. Books you couldn't wait to read pile up on the shelf while you juggle dinner and attempt homework help. Pre-calc? But I'm a writer. And an exhausting list of teenage babysitters who call you at work to ask things like how to make canned tomato soup. My daughters got older, and it got easier. Gone were the days of running to daycare at 5:59 and 59 seconds, hoping the door wasn't already locked, with my kids and their teacher outside awaiting my arrival. Eventually, they could take the bus home from school and later drive themselves around in my Honda Accord, which became a trash can for half-eaten Chipotle. That stage brought its own challenges. No, the car wasn't broken down, I explained on FaceTime to my frantic new driver as she was being sworn at for blocking a Starbucks drive-thru line. It just won't run without gas. I am finally beginning to catch my breath and strangely proud to have survived the chaos. But what now? While my whole identity has been inextricably linked to the triangle, have I been too busy to realize when exactly I stopped being my own person? For a lot of moms in my situation, what's missing is building a meaningful life beyond daily parenting, says Natalie Kane, founder of lifeintransition.org, based in Westport, Connecticut. Over nearly two decades, she has hosted workshops and support groups to help women navigate the empty nest phase of their lives. This jarring transition can lead some mothers and fathers to experience empty nest syndrome, a phenomena characterized by feelings of sadness, loss, or loneliness after a last child leaves home, according to the Mayo Clinic. And if these feelings become overwhelming, it's a good idea to seek medical help, the clinic warns. The key to getting through this phase, Kane says, is remembering that two opposites can happen simultaneously. You carry both the sadness that your role is changing, and you carry the joy of who you are becoming. Looking for some joy, I turned to the fabulous humorist Irma Bombeck, who said that mothers at this stage are upset because they've gone from supervisor of a child's life to spectator. It's like being the vice president of the United States. I guess I'm going to have to learn what a vice president does. As to who I am becoming, Kane tells me to be patient. It's going to take time to find a new rhythm. Researcher after researcher cites a shift toward authenticity in women around age 50, a desire to not simply muddle through, but to live with intention. A December study in the Journal of Midlife Health, humbling, isn't it? Highlights the potential for personal growth, discovering new passions, and building deeper relationships with others. That's what I want to accomplish. To do so, I envision my post-September life in almost technicolor glow, filled with exciting hobbies, beyond binging BritBox, my current go-to, and tending to my brand new yet shockingly abundant herb garden, and my, oh my God, can I join a book club? Some days I allow myself to get lost in the fantasy. I could pack it all up, sell my house, move to Spain, teach English. Or maybe it doesn't have to be that big. Maybe I can just learn how to successfully fold a burrito. Kane, who estimates she has advised more than 5,000 women, points to the deeper things, a focus on spirituality and wellness. The number one thing that I found in the thousands of parents is they focused on themselves and they became healthier, she says. They worked out. They changed their diet. My mind whirs as she speaks. Yes, yes, yes to all of that. I may not be jumping into hot yoga anytime soon, but I could start using that gym membership I've been paying for every month. It all sounds pretty amazing, until Kane hits me with this. There's guilt about that, because that's not how we were raised. Once a mom, always a mom. But now, she says, is not the time to let guilt take over. Pursuing your own interests and learning your likes and dislikes makes you more empathetic to what your kids are going through, she says. After all, they'll make lots of changes in the next year. They'll try and maybe fail, and so will you, but you'll all learn, and that's healthy. You're at the stage of open doors now, Kane says. Please don't call it empty nest. From the New York Times, looking past the stereotypes to get to the real Frida Kahlo, by Luis Lucero. Frida Kahlo didn't become one of the most famous figures of the 20th century by chance. The image of the artist that persists in Barbie dolls and on coffee mugs was a carefully constructed avatar. Proof, according to the costume designer John Bausor, that she was a living work of art. The daughter of an amateur photographer, Kahlo was aware of the power of visuals from an early age. She chose clothing that concealed her disability, but highlighted her heritage. She darkened her eyebrows, but refused to separate them. Whether posing for a photo or sitting for a self-portrait, she was always aware of her angles. "Everyone has a vision of Frida in their head," said Wilberth Gonzalez, who, along with Bausor, designed the costumes for El Último Sueño de Frida y Diego at the Metropolitan Opera. But often the men agreed that image is informed by trickle-down kitsch, a dress in a meaningless selection of colors, or a braided hairstyle adorned with a random bouquet. New York may be in the midst of one of its periodic flare-ups of Frida mania. An exhibition at the Museum of Modern Art features works by Kahlo and her husband, Diego Rivera. And frenzy can lead to flattening, turning a complex artist into an icon, a vibe. But for Kahlo, personal presentation was almost an extension of her artistic practice. Because to understand Frida Kahlo as a painter, it helps to understand her as a performance artist, forever putting on a show for the world. Her Tijuana dress, a strategic silhouette. Out of the fewer than 200 paintings that Kahlo made, roughly a third are self-portraits. Kahlo was usually her own muse, and her fascination came across in how she styled herself. She wore many types of dress, from men's suits to the post-Mexican Revolution China Poblana style. But in the popular consciousness, she is almost always imagined in the formal style of dress, particular to the isthmus of the Tehantepec in southern Mexico. The look consists of a Tijuana skirt, floor length, with a hem or flounce, often made of lace from Manchester, England, and a square-cut tunic-style blouse called a huipil that is often embroidered in bright colors or embellished with brocade. Kahlo frequently paired the skirt and top with a rebozo, a rectangular shawl sometimes used to swaddle babies, draped over her shoulders, sometimes wrapped around her waist. The garments created a silhouette that encouraged the eye to focus on her body from the waist up. The generously pleated skirt, known as an enagua, allowed her to conceal a right leg that was smaller than her left, a result of a bout with polio. Kahlo's many expressive and artisanal styles allowed her to control how she was seen, putting forward a body on her terms, regardless of how disembodied she might have felt. Cocooned in the Tijuana skirt, she hid the parts of herself that caused her the most pain, revealing them instead through her works. Her signature, blue, a shade as vibrant as she was. Mexico City has no shortage of colorful buildings. There are enough purples, pinks, oranges, and yellows dotting the streets to weave a technicolor dream coat. But there is only one, Casa Azul, the tourist-swarmed blue house in the bohemian neighborhood of Coyoacán, where Kahlo took her first and final breaths. Indeed, the building across the street from the family home is also blue, but it is not that blue. Approaching Casa Azul, which was opened to the public as a museum in 1958, it is impossible to miss the electric cobalt hue that seems to glow from within, undulating in the late afternoon sunlight that dapples through the lush trees and plants that dot the internal courtyard. The blue, which Kahlo is said to have chosen for its power to ward off evil, can also be seen at another of the artist's former homes in the San Angel neighborhood of Mexico City. And what of Yves Klein blue? More like Yves Klein who? The French artist didn't debut artwork featuring what would become his signature shade of ultramarine until several years after Kahlo's death. Her menswear. Three-piece suit or second skin? Where did she buy the suit? Who was the tailor or the haberdasher who would agree to outfit a teenage girl from Mexico's upper middle class in the garb of a man? In a family portrait orchestrated by Kahlo's father, her relatives are attired in clothes conforming to the conventions of their sex. Sleeveless chemises, or matronly frocks for the women, stayed suits for the men. The outlier is Frida, just 18, and at the start of her spectacular, eventful, and tragically brief existence. She died at 47. Frida, too, is dressed in a suit, a bulky three-piece with a vest buttoned tight, a high-collared shirt, and lace-up oxfords. Her hair is slicked down and parted in the middle. A dimpled necktie is at her throat. Her gaze is impudent and sure. In most of the countless interpretations this image has inspired, viewers have tended to focus on Kahlo's defiance of convention, of family portraiture, of middle-class propriety, of gender norms. Seldom remarked upon is the element that, in this viewer's eyes, is the most startling thing about the photograph. That is the family's seeming embrace of young Frida's desire to dress for an official family portrait as a man. Gender play continued to be intrinsic to Kahlo's experiments in self-expression. After a bitter divorce from the muralist Diego Rivera in 1940, she hacked off her luxuriant mane and painted herself in men's clothing for self-portrait with cropped hair. On view in the MoMA exhibition, Frida and Diego, The Last Dream. Swimming in a dark gray suit, her shorn locks scattered about her, a masculinized Frida seems to invert the myth of Samson. Cutting off her hair, she restores herself to power. Her animals. The zookeeper of Coyoacan. When Kahlo was growing up in the Casa Azul, her family home teemed with birds, cats, butterflies, dogs, and caterpillars. When she turned 6, becoming bedridden with polio, her pets kept her company, while her friends frolicked in the park outside. After her life-altering bus accident at 18, Kahlo's bond with them only deepened, and she would find solace in the company of animals for the rest of her life. There was her parrot, Bonito, who enjoyed perching on her shoulder. There was her fawn, Granzino, to whom she liked giving head scratches. Her hairless black dog, Signor Zolotto, sat beside her while she painted. When Rivera built a pyramid structure in the Casa Azul's garden, he created a sanctuary for his wife's menagerie, and her animals roamed around on it as if it were their own little kingdom. Her medical corsets, like a canvas under her chin. When the Victoria and Albert Museum in London held its blockbuster show, Frida Kahlo, Making Herself Up, in 2018, it included among the many self-portraits, photographs, and textiles, a handful of the 28 corsets Kahlo wore throughout her life, not because she wanted a smaller waist, but because a devastating bus accident when she was 18 snapped her spine and caused other excruciating injuries. On their own, these devices might have been torturous contraptions of plaster, straps, steel, and leather necessary to support her broken back. But in her hands, they became a literal canvas. Forced to lie in bed for months wearing the various corsets, Kahlo would paint them with the aid of a mirror, adorning their dull frames with birds, a hammer and sickle, an eye, a sun, and a fetus in utero. Sometimes she affixed tiny mirrors, like stars, to the plaster. When doctors took away her materials, she used lipstick and iodine instead. In doing so, she reclaimed the corsets, as well as her own pain, turning an orthopedic apparatus, not to mention the whole idea of signing someone's cast, into something glorious and indelible. Her prosthetic leg, an extension near the end of her life. As a child, Kahlo sought to hide her withered right leg, a deformity that she hated all her life. As Hayden Herrera wrote in her 1983 biography of the artist, by wearing multiple pairs of socks or long skirts. But Kahlo could not camouflage her limp, and other children mocked her by calling her Peg Leg. The 1925 collision that left her with a fractured spine, a crushed pelvis, and a shattered right leg also crushed her right foot, which would become a source of constant discomfort that often bordered on agony. From the accident onward, Herrera wrote, pain and fortitude became central themes in her life. Kahlo had been using a cane to help her walk even before the accident. In her final years, as her physical problems mounted, she had no choice but to rely on it as a sort of extension of her physical body, a pragmatic tool, and a symbol of the role she adopted, both in life and in her first-person art, as the heroic sufferer, according to Herrera. Kahlo underwent at least 32 surgical operations in the years after the accident, but it was not until 1953, about 11 months before her death, that her lower right leg was amputated because of gangrene. But here too was an opportunity for art, and perhaps for joy in the face of misery. To get around on her flesh-colored prosthesis, Kahlo wore red leather boots that she adorned with little bells. They would ring when she danced. Her unibrow, the line of beauty. About 5 years before she died, Kahlo sat for interviews with her friend Olga Campos, who was then studying to become a psychologist. In one interview, the artist belittles almost every single one of her physical attributes. Her polio-stricken leg, her breasts, her head, and faint mustache. But she told Campos, "I like the eyebrows and the eyes. Aside from that, I like nothing." A feature common in many non-European cultures, in which thick hair, facial or otherwise, is often regarded as a sort of ancestral treasure, Kahlo's unibrow was a signifier of her being. It was constant in her many self-portraits, even as they depicted the shifting context of her life. Whether the painting was somber, decorated with animals, or stripped of every discernible Kahloism, that thick, untamed wave asserted itself. So central is that single line of hair to her likeness that when Mattel introduced a Kahlo Barbie in 2018, with a gap where her brows would typically meet, it caused an uproar. "Take away that brow," her fans said, "and you have merely a feeble impersonator." Kahlo declined to pluck her brow at a time when pencil-thin arches were popularized by movie stars like Greta Garbo and Rita Hayworth, instead keeping them big and bold in defiance of Western beauty standards. She combed them regularly and filled them in with a black powder meant to simulate growth, according to Campos, whose interviews were later published in Solomon Grimberg's book, Frida Kahlo, Song of Herself. In 2004, hidden among possessions locked away for 50 years, archivists found another clue about how she cultivated her image, a Revlon eyebrow pencil in ebony. From Costco Connection, healthy car snacks, nutritious foods to pack for a road trip, by Ellen Ryan. A family car trip doesn't have to include the bloat and expense of fast food. By toting your own, you can pass around snacks that everyone will like, whether you're heading out for a few hours or a few days. Yue Lee, a registered dietitian with Nova Scotia Health in Halifax, makes suggestions based on USDA, MyPlate, and Canada's Food Guide. Include as many food groups as possible for both health and satiety, So you're not hungry again soon, she says. Good snacks combine colors, textures, and nutrition offerings. Here are car-friendly suggestions. Protein. Hard-boiled eggs are self-contained. Cut them in half ahead of time and add salt and pepper. A small container can hold sandwiches so they don't get crushed or dented. Use whole wheat bread for fiber. Opt for tuna salad or PB&J, or add some fun with veggie sticks and pretzels to dip into hummus and guacamole. Nuts add convenience between meals. Before you head out, bake your own protein bars or muffins. If you're traveling with kids, get them involved. Kids are more likely to eat what they make, says Lee. Fruits and vegetables. Clementines and bananas are easy to pack and peel. Ditto applesauce cups, carrots, cucumbers, and sweet peppers. Before you leave, wash fruits and veggies for at least 30 seconds. Dry with a paper towel. To avoid choking hazards, have grapes and cherry tomatoes for younger children, Lee advises. Dairy. Individually wrapped cheeses are great for car trips because they're mess-free, says Lee. Yogurt pouches are convenient and allow for choice. Whole grains. Before leaving, try spreading a whole grain tortilla or pita with nut butter and rolling it around a banana, then wrapping with plastic wrap. Or add cubed melon and berries to a crepe spread with cream cheese. Water, low-fat milk, and juice are good drink choices. With a little planning, at home or at the store, says Lee, travel snacking can be both healthy and fun. Safe and fresh. For perishables, a cooler with a cold pack or ice is best, says registered dietitian Leah Oladachian. Keep food below 40 degrees and discard food that has been above that temperature for over 2 hours. You'll need to refill ice and or refreeze cold packs for longer trips. Sealable containers are ideal for fruit and spillable foods. Seal wraps in plastic food storage bags or plastic wraps. And that brings us to the end of the program. I'm Mary Ellen. Thank you for joining me. And please join me again for the Women's Hour.
This is Bird Note. This young northern flicker is calling from the ground. Sound like trouble? Well, just because a young bird is on the ground doesn't necessarily mean it's sick or injured. At this time of year, juvenile northern flickers are leaving their nests. They fledge when they're 3 or 4 weeks old and almost as big as their parents, 11 or 12 inches long. Although you may picture a woodpecker high on a tree trunk, northern flickers, young and old, actually forage mostly on the ground. So this young flicker, just out of its nest, is poking around in the dirt and leaf litter, looking for ants and other insects. It makes test flights and, day by day, reaches higher and higher into the trees. But you'll still see it regularly, beak down in your lawn probing for food. The best thing you can do for the young flicker, and other fledgling birds too, is to give the bird some space. And especially, keep your cats indoors. Next spring, this bird will probably be drumming on your roof, advertising for a mate. To learn what to do if you do find a sick or injured bird, visit our website, birdnote.org. We'll help you find your local wildlife rehabilitator. I'm Mary McCann. Bird Note's newsletter delivers the wonder and joy of birds directly to your inbox. Sign up at birdnote.org to get a weekly preview of our shows, stories, photos, and more.